while the wolves are preying on calves, we'll be praying that somehow this herd can get through another year so that we can take some management actions next year.
The state loses its court battle to conduct predator control on Unimak Island. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 7th of June. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the cool weather has helped slow wildfire progress, but the fight isn't over.
You know, it's basically like a sleeping dragon. If we get a couple days of dry and wind, it'll be up and running again.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The state lost its court bid today to begin targeted aerial predator control this week in its effort to boost the Unimak Island caribou herd. A federal court judge sided with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who manages most of the island as the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. But the judge also said the state's arguments appealed to common sense, APRN's Annie Feit reports.
As a practical matter, the state says its case is over. Bill McAllister is communications director for the Alaska Department of Law.
Well, this was seemingly the last gasp for our emergency predator control plan, which was to go in and kill seven wolves so that the state of this depleted herd would not get any worse.
The state argued the caribou's depleted numbers required immediate action. They wanted to begin killing wolves this week to protect the island's newborn calves while they're most vulnerable. But the federal government said it needed more time to review the state's controversial plan under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. Larry Bell with the agency's External Affairs Department says he's pleased with the decision.
We've maintained all along that we believe NEPA is the proper process to go through for evaluating a range of alternatives that will allow us to continue to meet our mandate, and included among that is natural diversity and a mandate for providing subsistence opportunity.
In announcing the decision, Judge Russell Holland sounded like he wished he could have sided with the state. He said he needed to follow the law, but the state's arguments appealed to, quote, one's desire to get things moving where action is needed. Bell says the Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't think the Unimak herd requires emergency action.
This is an urgent situation and one that needs to be addressed, but it's, in our view, not so urgent that we don't have time to complete a thorough analysis so that the management action we select will be not only a well-founded, but a lasting management action in furtherance of our mandates.
But the state maintains that failing to act this year could put the herd in a position it can't recover from. And Bill McAllister says the situation may be even more dire than biologists thought. He says the results from an aerial survey conducted this week were alarming.
They counted 178 animals, as opposed to the 400 animals that have been cited in the record here as being a population on the verge of dying out. And among those 178 were only seven bulls. So actually, the situation is much worse than was presented in the court record.
The residents of False Pass haven't been able to hunt caribou on the island since 2008. Cindy Beamer is the manager of the local Isinotsky Corporation. She calls the ruling very disappointing. She says residents do have other options for meat, but the caribou aren't just a food source.
It's the heritage aspect of it, too. You know, hunting is a way of life, and then the children aren't, you know, learning about it if they can't do it, so it affects, you know, that part of the life, too. So it's not just the food, it's the cultural aspect.
Beamer says the longer managers wait to take action, the harder it will be to increase the herd's population numbers. She thinks the island's caribou will be extinct in 5 years if nothing is done. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says it is taking some action to save the herd. It will issue a permit to the state this week to translocate 20 bulls to the island. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Damp, cool weather has allowed crews to make good progress on the highest priority wildfire response in the state. Over 700 firefighters are working the Eagle Trail Fire, which has burned more than 18,000 acres over the last 2 weeks near Tok. Response team spokeswoman Sarah Sarlos says crews are using the break in the weather to try to get around the front of the fire.
Everything's buttoned up around the Alaska Highway, down around Tana Cross and the Eagle Subdivision. Now we're pushing north and west to hook this thing.
Sarlo says the perimeter of the fire is about 18 miles long, and most of it is in remote country, requiring access by helicopter or boat on the Tanana River. She says cool, misty weather has subdued flames, but the fire is not out.
There's still a lot of heat in there. And you know, when the guys go and fly it, they're saying that, you know, it's basically like a sleeping dragon. If we get a couple days of dry and wind, it'll be up and running again.
Sarlo says the forecast is for a gradual warming and drying trend this week. She says the biggest area of fuels is on the northwestern front, where the fire made a 2-mile run through white spruce in the Tanana Valley State Forest last week. The Eagle Trail fire is listed as 28% contained. Meanwhile, in south central, the fires in the upper Kuskokwim area have quieted down, but one of them is within 5 miles of the Roan River Roadhouse now. Efforts continue to protect structures in that area. In western Alaska, a brush grass and tundra fire near Kwikset is threatening a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service camp. It got about a mile closer on Sunday and is estimated at 2,400 acres. The Marine Stewardship Council's eco-label is supposed to make grocery shopping easy for the environmentally conscious. It's just like the free-range sticker on chicken or the organic tag on produce. You pick out your fish, look for the blue label, and take home your sustainable dinner. This week, the Marine Stewardship Council decided to add its eco-label to Alaska's flatfish fishery, certifying a number of trawl-caught species. But some conservationists think it's a mistake that could mislead consumers. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The Marine Stewardship Council has certified Alaska's flatfish fisheries for complying with this environmental standard. Trawl-caught species like arrowtooth flounder, Alaska plaice, and sole will now be able to bear the council's blue eco label. Carrie Coughlin, the Marine Stewardship Council's America's Regional Director, says that flatfish caught in the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska area now meet the council's requirement for sustainability.
Our standard is basically three principles, and that would be the health of the stock, that it has to be maintained or growing going forward, around the marine ecosystem, that there's no harm to the ecosystem, and around ongoing good management of the fishery. And those are the three basic principles.
But John Warrenchuk, a marine biologist with the conservation group Oceana, disagrees with the sustainability certification. He says that fisheries are being rewarded for merely cutting down on bad behavior.
It's a good idea and concept to have some sort of environmentally friendly or green labeling of seafood. But this particular label is somewhat misleading in that you can give certification to fisheries for simply being the best of the worst.
Warrenchuk says that the method for catching flatfish does lasting damage to ocean habitats. He also expresses concerns about bycatch in the trawl fisheries.
We have to take a hard look. Is it really worth catching 100 million pounds of flatfish if you're going to waste 10 million pounds of halibut?
Coughlin maintains that effects on the bottom habitats have been minimized and that bycatch has been reduced.
The certifier looked closely at that and determined that the trawl fishing did not have an effect on the marine ecosystem, including bottom habitats.
The Best Use Cooperative, a coalition of fishing companies that requested the MSC certification, says that it has taken efforts to reduce both habitat destruction and bycatch. The cooperative's president, Bill Orr, who is also vice president of the Seattle-based fishing company Iquique US, says the action by the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council made certification easier, but that gear has also improved in recent years.
We've spent a lot of time on developing the fishing gear so that it is more selective, by using devices that exclude halibut, for example, and we've been able to dramatically reduce our halibut bycatch and mortality.
Orr says that MSC certification is becoming economically vital for fishing companies, and that the MSC eco label is becoming an industry standard.
One thing it does is promotes the image of our fishery as sustainable and one that is eco-friendly. The MSC logo is becoming more and more accepted, and as a matter of fact, it's becoming more and more demanded by our customers, particularly those in Europe.
In 2004, the MSC first certified the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands pollock fisheries and provoked many of the same complaints from conservation groups about the sustainability of trawling. Though pollock has maintained its MSC certification, the fish has become harder to find in recent years. Warren Chuck says that bycatch levels have also fluctuated since the MSC certified the pollock fishery.
It peaked during the certification process, but has reduced, been on the decline since about 2008, I believe. But it was stamped and certified while the bycatch was out of control.
The Marine Stewardship Council will review the flatfish fishery certification annually and will repeat the certification process in 5 years. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the increasing sea otter population in Southeast is troubling commercial divers in the region.
We watched those areas disappear, not go from like not commercially viable. I mean, there was none left.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The University of Dubuque has walked away from a deal to operate part of the Sheldon Jackson College campus in Sitka. The private Iowa university was exploring the possibility of launching some sort of operation in Sitka, but its president said today that Dubuque, the city of Sitka, and the management of the former Sheldon Jackson College could not agree on how to move forward. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
University of Dubuque President Jeffrey Bullock released a public letter saying his university is going to step away from the table.
You know, that's the way these things go. We did our best, and we invested a couple of years in it. And ultimately, we came to the conclusion that what the Sheldon Jackson board was looking for was not what we felt comfortable delivering.
Bullock says in his letter that the Sheldon Jackson board was looking for someone to take over the entire campus and run it as it was previously run. He says Dubuque's leaders don't believe that's the right way to pursue education in Sitka. Members of the board, along with Sheldon Jackson College President David Dobler, could not be reached for comment on Monday. Bullock says Dubuque was willing to put up money from its donors and was looking for more money from the city of Sitka than the city was willing to give.
In the configuration that I believe the city was looking for, I don't think there was a prayer for this thing to be supported or successful financially.
He says city leaders made a verbal commitment of significant dollars and then moved to what he called a, quote, maybe in the future type of arrangement, unquote. He also says Dubuque did not have the full political support of city leaders.
I guess I can only speak for myself and say that I think that the tone and the assignment of blame on the city side is a surprise, and I don't think that it's accurate.
Sitka Mayor Scott McAdams.
We spent our time, our treasure, our political capital on not only getting to know Dubuque, but also advocating in the state for example, the purchase of the Stratton Library for use at Sheldon Jackson Museum was part of trying to restructure the college's debt. So I think that the city, myself included, did do due diligence on the political end.
McAdams graduated from Sheldon Jackson in 2000. He says the city has to weigh the costs of putting money into Dubuque against the benefits it would have in the community.
I don't see how the city had the capacity to be able to both restructure $12 million in college debt and then try to come up with another $6 or $7 million. $5, $6, or $7 million to seed a Dubuque enterprise that would have at least initially brought very few jobs and a very limited scope of services to the community.
Dubuque's interest in Sheldon Jackson first popped up a couple years ago. Both schools have affiliation with the Presbyterian Church, and Dubuque itself nearly suffered the fate of Sheldon Jackson, coming close to closure about 10 years ago. Bullock, its current president, helped lead the turnaround, and officials in Sitka were hoping that the same thing could happen here. Meanwhile, not everyone in Sitka thinks that Dubuque's departure is a bad thing. Sitka resident Nancy Yaw Davis's father, Leslie Yaw, was first president of Sheldon Jackson College. She's been vocal about her wish to see it remain as intact as possible and hopes one day to see it used again for educational purposes. But she says now that Dubuque is out of the picture, the potential for the campus is unlimited.
Art programs, music programs, science programs, there can be businesses, new businesses on campus. There could be a wholesome extension of this really incredibly exciting town with historic content.
With help from KCAW's Robert Woolsey and Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg, I'm Ed Ronco reporting in Sitka.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks is facing a budget shortfall. University Vice Chancellor of Administration Pat Pitney says UAF is $5.5 million short, while its rural and Tanana Valley campuses have a $700,000 deficit. Pitney says the situation reflects escalating costs and flat research income from outside sources.
The legislature funded most of the requested compensation and fixed cost items, but our other revenue sources haven't increased sufficiently to cover the other part of those fixed costs.
Pitney attributes the stagnation in research to space limitations for laboratory and other work at UAF. She says that's why the university has been pushing for a new life sciences facility. That project will go before voters as part of a bond package, but Pitney says in the meantime, UAF has to refocus on covering existing commitments and priority programs. She says job losses will result.
We do anticipate there will be some level of layoffs. This is a significant enough reallocation that not all units can do it with other than people funding. So much of our base budget is personnel costs that it's not all places are going to be able to do it without some layoff.
Pitney sent a letter to university faculty and staff last week explaining the situation and a plan that calls on UAF units to cut back between 2.5% and 6.5%. Pitney says some areas have already been affected by the budget crunch, citing reductions in athletics at public radio and TV station KUAC and the outsourcing of the campus bookstore. Pitney says the University of Alaska Anchorage is not facing a similar situation as it doesn't rely as heavily on outside research dollars. The first-degree murder trial of Rachelle Waterman has been delayed until January. Scheduling a new trial date was the subject of a status hearing Friday in Ketchikan Superior Court. The court also took up a request to move the trial out of Ketchikan. KRBD's Maria Dudzak reports.
Waterman is accused of conspiring to kill her mother with Klawak resident Jason Arendt and Craig resident Brian Riddell. Both men pled guilty in 2004 to the first-degree murder of 48-year-old Lori Waterman. Rachelle Waterman's first trial was held in Juneau and ended in a hung jury. She was to be retried in Ketchikan this month. Waterman's attorney, Stephen Wells, asked the court to delay the trial. Wells is currently involved in another trial in Anchorage. Superior Court Judge William Carey was reluctant to delay the start of the trial but agreed. On Friday, a trial date of January 18th was set. Also Friday, Carey denied a request by Wells for a change of venue. Carey says after reviewing defense polling surveys of area residents, he believes that Waterman can get a fair trial in Ketchikan.
Publicity here in Southeast Alaska, certainly over the past year, has been pretty straightforward, has not been excessive, has not involved any emotionally charged editorials or things of that nature. There's been little or no feedback online to articles in the Ketchikan Daily News regarding continuance. Really, the only issue that's been coming up over the past several months is when this trial is going to go.
Carey informed Wells that he could renew his request for a change of venue during jury selection. Another status hearing in the Waterman case is scheduled for December 15th. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service plans to survey Southeast Alaska's growing sea otter population this summer. The federal agency discussed its survey plans and heard from concerned commercial divers during a community forum in Ketchikan last week. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has this report.
About 20 people, most of whom were commercial divers, turned out for the Ketchikan Sea Otter Forum. Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association Executive Director Phil Doherty says the region's expanding sea otter population is of paramount concern to the region's commercial dive industry.
The sea otters are primary predators of everything that we fish for. And in a number of areas, they have completely wiped out the sea urchin and sea cucumber fisheries. Not only do they eat the easy prey like urchins and cucumbers, but they dig up geoducks.
Doherty says the economic consequences could be dire for commercial divers.
Over the long term, if there isn't some sort of more active management plan for sea otters, we'll see the dive fisheries, which this year had an ex vessel value of over $8 million, I'm not going to say completely wiped out, but certainly scaled back tremendously.
It's not just commercial divers who are concerned about the growth of sea otters in the region. The region's Dungeness crab fishermen are also worried. A number of crab fishermen showed up to a similar forum in Petersburg on Wednesday. U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologist Doug Byrne says sea otters were reestablished in Alaska in the 1960s after the mammals were decimated by earlier overhunting.
American fur hunters continued until 1911. When sea otters were fully protected from all hunting under an international fur seal treaty. At that time, worldwide, there might have been about 1,000 to 2,000 sea otters left.
Byrne says 400 sea otters were dropped off at six locations around the state 40 to 45 years ago. He says most of the sea otters found in the state today are descendants of those transplanted otters. Since the 1960s, the sea otter population has grown to around 75,000 in Alaska. While the population has declined markedly in southwest Alaska, it has been steadily growing in southeast. At last count, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimated there were around 11,500 sea otters in the southeast region. Federal wildlife biologist Verena Gill says sea otters are the only marine mammals without blubber. She says that means they have a high metabolic rate that requires them to eat large amounts of food.
The sea otter diet is actually extremely diverse, and they eat many, many different things. But you have animals that are specialists. Some otters, for example, specialize on seabirds. There are a few that do that. Or they're clam eaters predominantly. And a lot of times you can tell, for example, if they're urchin eaters, you'll see their teeth are stained purple.
Because sea otters eat what humans eat, Gill says there is often a conflict between the marine mammals and people. She says there are some benefits to having a healthy sea otter population.
They keep out invasives. You probably down here have all been aware of the Asian green crab, and you've been on the lookout for the Asian green crab. They do have Asian green crabs in California. And the only reason they haven't been a problem for people down there are the sea otters and Elkhorn Slough, for example, down by Monterey Bay, have been keeping the Asian green crab in check.
Sea otters are protected in southeast under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which prohibits nearly all hunting of the mammals. Alaska natives are allowed to hunt the sea otters for subsistence and traditional craft purposes. Around 200 to 400 sea otters are harvested in southeast annually. A number of divers attending Thursday's meeting worried the annual harvest isn't enough to keep the sea otter population in check. Diver Tom Carruth says he's watched as sea otters have wiped out areas once ripe with shellfish.
On the inside of Baker and Sumas, and we watched those areas disappear, not go from like not commercially viable. I mean, there was none left. And I watched that happen within 1 year.
Fish and Wildlife Service biologists attending Thursday's meeting said while the agency can limit harvests of sea otters, it has no ability to restrict the growth of otters in Southeast. That's again because they're protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Any changes to the act would require a vote by Congress. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is planning to conduct a new count of sea otters in Southeast this July. Results from the count should be available next fall or winter. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Matanuska Susitna Borough voters will be asked to decide on a new form of government come October. At present, the borough's manager directs the day-to-day operations of the borough. Last week, the borough assembly approved a measure that would allow voters to repeal the management style in favor of a strong mayoral form of government. If voters approve, the elected mayor of the Matsu borough would direct operations, hire and fire employees, and fill assembly directives. Current borough mayor Talis Colbert.
I think it's appropriate. I think it's something that the borough is ready to make the transition to. The question had been brought up during the campaign when I ran for mayor both times, and at that time I supported it as well. But I think it's a timely move. Mr. Duffy is leaving, so it opens the window for change, and I think this is the time to do it.
Borough Manager John Duffy has handed in his resignation and will leave his job at the end of June. Kohlberg says Duffy's resignation prompted new discussions on the strong mayor question. The borough is searching for a new manager.
The decision to hire a new manager wouldn't be in a completion stage until nearly the time of the election in any event. So what's probably likely to happen is the assembly will gather applicants who are interested, see what the outcome is in the October election, and if the voters don't approve a strong mayor, then they'll probably go ahead and select the manager, and so they're ready to go.
The Conservative Patriots group put the question before the assembly. The majority of assembly members approved the move. Kohlberg says he's not sure if he is interested in working as a full-time mayor. Kohlberg has advocated a strong mayor form of government, but he already works for the state as a Labor Department hearing officer. He says he won't make a decision between his current job and taking on a new role until after the voters decide on which form of government to use. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Maria Dudzak and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.